You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today I'm talking with Kieran Holmes-Darby, who is the co-founder of XL Esports, an esports organization based in London. The Holmes-Darby brothers formed XL Esports. It started in a bar, right?
A pub.
A pub.
Of course.
Pub.
We're British, after all. The competitiveness that you're obviously sensing comes from sports. You know, I played to a pretty high level in football. You'll learn something from everyone you meet. And if someone you haven't seen in a year, you'll probably learn something from them. If those people in your worst times or darker times are reaching out to you, there's that saying that's like, when the tide goes out, you'll see you swimming naked. Like the people that are swimming naked are your mates. Like they're the ones.
Not heard that one. I'm not going to use that ever again. Make sure to follow for future episodes. It really does mean a lot. I hope you enjoy this conversation as we get to know Kieran beyond the game. Well, thank you very much for coming along, Kieran. Appreciate you coming, and especially as you're one of the first guests who's behind the scenes, which was a big idea behind this whole Beyond the Game, was to bring people in, not just in front of camera, not just content creators and pro players, people who've worked behind the scenes. So, Kieran, I want to know your journey before you got to where you are now that led you to be a behind-the-scenes esports org creator extraordinaire.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a good question. I don't think I've ever been asked about the sort of like formative years before. I don't really know where to start. Probably in gaming makes sense. So growing up, I was always a part of initially a World of Warcraft guild, and then a Call of Duty clan. And we're talking, I'm aged like anywhere between 10 to 14 at this point. And I always took like leadership roles in these because back in those days, you didn't do a lot of like voice comms or talking or anything. It was all typing. So no one knew how old I was. So I got loads of like leadership roles at like the age of 11, like basically bossing adults around on how to like, whether it was, you know, in a clan, in the Call of Duty, like clans, we used to run boot camps where to teach people how to play Call of Duty properly. Or in World of Warcraft guilds, it was like raiding and dungeons and things like this. And I was, taking leadership roles from an extremely early age. When voice comms came in, so like TeamSpeak came in, a lot of people thought I was a girl initially because my voice hadn't broken. And I kind of rolled with it for a little bit and I was like, actually, I need to just come clean that I'm actually just like a 13-year-old kid. And then I lost a lot of my leadership roles when people found out how old I was. But I think that was quite formative. Yeah, for me, that's my behind the scenes bit.
And before that, so you said that was in your early teens and just before.
Yeah.
What sort of games were you playing when you were first, like what's your first game you remember really getting into?
Crash Bandicoot, those sorts of games. And what was it called? Crash Team Racing.
I think
Nitro
so.
Or Nitro Kart.
Nitro like the Kart Mario Kart equivalents.
Yeah, yeah, those. So I used to, so my parents are divorced, so every 2 weeks I would go to my dad's with my brother, and the three of us, because my dad only saw us every 2 weeks, he just let us do all the things that you're not supposed to do as a kid. So like we'd have all of the fizzy drinks possible. We'd stay up really late playing video games, you know, doing all the things that obviously mum wouldn't allow us to do as a kind of normal parent. So we go there every 2 weeks. And yeah, some of my earliest kind of fondest memories are on a Saturday night, staying up really late, playing like Crash Bandicoot with my dad and my brother, or yeah, Crash Team Racing or whatever it was.
Joel, brother.
My brother Joel, yeah.
Tell me more about Joel, because I feel like in a lot of sporting stories, we hear about that inbuilt rivalry partner,
yeah.
Someone to push you, develop you within brothers and sisters and that sort of camaraderie that you see. And yours is a pretty special story of you, the brothers who formed an esports org.
Yeah.
So tell me about your relationship with Joel.
Good question. I don't think we were that competitive with each other growing up. I think he was old enough, because he's 3.5 years older than me. I think he was old enough that I didn't compete directly with him. I just copied everything he did. So everything he got into, whether it was gaming, whether it was paintball back in the day, whatever it was, I got really into as well. Same, like even now, we both do CrossFit and I only do that because he got into it. You know, it's the same, even though we're a lot older now. So basically I just got into everything he got into. And yeah, gaming was one of those things that I suppose we really bonded on growing up. So whether it was playing, going to Blockbuster and renting the latest Gears of War to play the campaign as a duo, like those sorts of things. We always gamed together. I even remember, I can't remember what he was doing. Maybe he was filling out like a university application or something. He was really busy one Boxing Day, when Boxing Day was always me and Joel play games together every Boxing Day. And he was really busy. And maybe it was a university application, or maybe it was just an assignment at university or something. And we got Skyrim. And I played it all day with him sitting there just tabbing out of his university stuff, telling me where to go and what to do. He never touched the controller. I completed the whole game, but we were there doing it together. So it's those sorts of memories I have with Joel, and yeah, probably just a standard big brother protective relationship. And I was the little brother who could never do anything wrong, because he just protected me from all the rubbish. So yeah.
I resonate a lot with that. My brother's 3.5 years older, and sporting wise, we were rivals. Gaming-wise, we were rivals in a lot of games, but we found ourselves better at one game over the other.
Yeah.
So that would be where, like, my brother was more of a shooter fan, so
yeah.
I would watch him play shooters. I was more of a Nintendo fan. He would watch me play through Nintendo games.
Yeah.
We sort of had that relationship you described of a sort of backseat watching,
yeah.
But giving a bit of advice here and there. And
it's funny because I used to love playing games with him. I used to love watching him play games as well. You know, I was quite happy just to watch at times. But we're best mates. We're super similar in a lot of ways, but we're very, very different in other ways. So like when it came to sport, I was probably the higher achiever. So we never really like competed directly. Like sometimes growing up, I remember playing football for his teams, bearing in mind I'm 3.5 years younger. And so I probably overachieved more on the sporting side. But he was always better at like games and stuff than me. So yeah, we just had, we were different in a lot of ways, but also very similar in other ways.
See, I don't resonate with that. I was just better than my brother at everything. So, no, I mean, I think he definitely achieved in a lot of other ways, but I think the having older brother to aim for, it puts you at a higher level, especially in sport.
Yeah.
I also used to find with cricket, you'd find the younger brothers would get better at bowling because everyone wants to bat. So the older brother's batting, the younger brother has to work out a way to get them out, to get their chance to bat.
Yeah.
And then consequently, all the brotherly pairs at the clubs I've played at, the younger one's a bowler, the older one's a batter.
That's funny. Yeah, Joel never played cricket. That's one of the only sports that I've played that he hasn't. But I suppose that goes back to it. He wasn't really like that sporting inclined. I mean, yeah, gym and stuff, but not like sports. But yeah, we were very, I suppose, very different in that way, but also, yeah, just very similar in a lot of ways.
And a lot of those differences is what led to the success of you two as a duo when it came to forming XL.
100%.
And I will get back to the whole XL story, but before we I like to ask all my guests their top 5 games of all time.
Oh, wow.
And you've mentioned a lot through that. And this is important for you because so many games have been important in your career. So it's not just games that you've played a lot of, although I'm sure something like WoW will probably end up being in there.
Yeah.
But I want to hear the games that have been the most important games in your life, whether it be through enjoyment, influence, or you just particularly have good memories from them.
Okay, probably no order, right? Because that's going to take too long to try and like think out the actual order of these. But I think the most important game in my life, and it's probably, to be honest, more from a career thing than anything, than sort of a fun and enjoyment perspective, although it is fun and enjoyable, is League of Legends. Just purely because that's what gave XL its real like tier one status and its leg up. You know, working closely with Riot. I also have a lot of admiration for what Riot Games are doing, and just I just think they're good at what they do. Which is why I also like the new games coming out like Valorant and things like that. So, but League of Legends definitely be one. In terms of, I think the best game ever made still today is World of Warcraft. Like, I just don't think you can beat it. I've played lots of other things that have come along that are similar. Every 2 years they release new content. There's always, you know, brilliant. I mean, a lot of people disagree with that and don't love every expansion. The one that's just come out, Dragonflight, is fantastic. And I think everyone agrees that, you know, they've really hit out the park with that. So, and also I've played that since 2007, since vanilla. So yeah, for me, World of Warcraft's probably number one. Other influentials, I mentioned a couple that are probably going to come up again, but Gears of War. Gears of War for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of playing the campaigns with my brother. But number two, the multiplayer, I got really good. It's probably the game that I was best at from a sort of competition perspective, whether it was smashing the game battles, ladders or whatever. I was actually quite good at Gears of War. It's the only game that I've ever been quite good at. The one just before that that's super important to me is Halo. So again,
which one?
So I started Halo 3. I wasn't necessarily sort of old school when it came to Halo. But when ODST came out and all of the good players continued to play Halo 3, I was one of the better players on ODST because all of the pros were sort of like, didn't like ODST for whatever reason. So I was one of the best players on Halo 3 ODST, but mainly because the competition wasn't as hard, if I'm honest with myself. But yeah, those like grinding to have a level 50, like those sorts of times, that was super important. I can't not mention Call of Duty. Played it since Modern Warfare, classic, like Christmas noob, got my 360, got Call of Duty 4. And that was like my first competitive online experience playing multiplayer Call of Duty. And also was the thing that and Halo got me into esports. So watching initially some MLG like game battle stuff on Halo, but then big time, like when Black Ops 2 came around with Call of Duty, I was fully invested in that. When we started XL, my one page like business plan was be the Optic Gaming of the UK, right? That was really what we aspired to be. So, and Call of Duty was the first team we had that went pro. So yeah, also Call of Duty, super important from a career perspective, but also a personal enjoyment perspective.
I'm going to force you to pick a Call of Duty, which is a tough one because it's one of those games, it's like FIFA or any of those kind of games where the whole category is enough. But
so yeah, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say two, because career would be Black Ops 2, just because that got me into esports. But out of personal enjoyment, probably Modern Warfare 2, because like, again, on Christmas, playing against all the Christmas noobs and getting all your nukes, you know, collecting those nukes was a good fun part of my gaming career. So
I detect a little bit of, I enjoy being better than people.
That's been my life the whole
time. Maybe a younger you would have been a serial smurfer just to get that that feeling out of playing against weaker players.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem was because I was good at games if you looked at like me in my school, right? I was the best Call of Duty player in my school by a long way, you know. And in school, everyone was like, oh, Kieran's the Call of Duty guy, like he's the gamer. But then when I started to broaden out into esports, I realized I was actually quite bad compared to the broader spectrum. So yeah, I always liked being better than people, but I wasn't actually that good.
Which is why you decided to get people under your wings who were better people with XL.
That is exactly why.
I'm interested because another question I always ask in the formative year questions, so we find out about your top five games, but I'm really interested to find out what your greatest gaming achievement is. Now, How you interpret that again is up to you, because for some people that will be something they've done in game, like 100%ing a game.
Yeah.
But for some other people, it might be a sentimental feeling around a success in the esports industry or a career-based success. So for you, what would you say your greatest gaming achievement is?
It's a really good question. It's going to be a rogue answer as well, which you won't expect. I was part of the best Titanfall team worldwide. Did you ever play Titanfall?
I didn't know.
It was like Call of Duty, Halo, but with Titans. Like, you would jump into these like huge rocket ships and play. And we grinded the game battles ladder on that. So hard. And me, my brother, obviously, and a couple of other people, we grinded that game. And yeah, we were the best team worldwide. So I've actually been the best at a game. Not a game that many people have played.
How long did that last?
A few weeks. There was this other European team that came along that were really good. And then we kept meeting them in the finals of these tournaments, and it would go either way. Uh-huh. But for a time, I was part of the best ever Titanfall team.
So when I'm speaking to you about all this stuff, I get the feeling that you probably would have been an esports pro if the timing had been different. Just with the way you talk and think about gaming, I think you're just in the wrong space at the wrong time.
Just to answer that, the competitiveness that you're obviously sensing comes from sports. You know, I played to a pretty high level in football, and I wanted to be a professional footballer, as many young British boys are and want to be, and girls now, which is great. But yeah, back in the day, pretty much, I think if you asked a group of, you know, 11-year-old boys, I'd say 90% of them would turn around and be like, I want to be a footballer, right? I was one of those. And I got closer than most, but not like close enough to be like, I was almost there, and then my knee went out and, you know, yeah, whatever. Yeah. I played in academies and stuff like that. And that, you know, when that wasn't a realistic goal for me, sort of it just came through to gaming, right? Like, want to be the best at whatever game I'm playing. And there's obviously a natural ability to being a professional esports player that I didn't have. Grinded games, I was pretty good, but I never had whatever that like natural ability is that they have. I don't have that. So it was never a realistic goal.
Yeah, interesting. I think the next section we should definitely talk about is what happened next for you after this sort of realization. And for a lot of people who've heard you speak about XL before, and I've heard this story so many times, I think it's important that we go back down the famous story of how the Holmes Derby brothers formed XL Esports. So yeah. It started in a bar, right?
A pub. Of course.
Pub.
We're British, after all. So a lot of people heard this story, but happy to tell it again. So again, at this point, we are, you know, we'd competed in Call of Duty, Joel and I, on, you know, various different teams. We started playing in like the game battles, which for those of you who don't know, was a big like matchmaking site where you could actually win some cash. And they used to run these 2Ks, which initially were 2,000 euros for the tournament. And then later on, they just became points on game battles as opposed to actual cash. But when it was actual cash, we were playing in these 2Ks, and you'd get maybe like 200 teams in Europe playing, and we normally got first rounded or second rounded, or, you know, maybe we made the third round if we were lucky on 1 week. And we're like, yeah, we're not very good. Like, let's have a look at these teams that are actually getting quite far in the tournament. What are they doing? And we just got fascinated by, you know, people being good at this, you know, at this what is now dubbed esports. And we're like, well, you know what, we're pretty commercially minded, like, we love this space. Joel was at KPMG at the time, so his management consultant. I was studying for a law degree. You know, we're pretty like corporate setups. Like, why don't we just like start a team, like as a passion project? And I joked about this for like, I say jokes, like I kept dropping in every time someone made like a really good play in Call of Duty, I'd be like, sign him for XL. Like, I'd thought of the name already because I was a massive Envious fan. Don't know if you, I mean, Envy, rest in peace. But Envy was my team growing up, like Rambo, Ray, and Hastro, those guys I really looked up to. And they had, and it's as simple as that, they had envy, which as a word could be shortened to NV, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool. So I was like, what other words that are, you know, kind of cool that you can you shorten to just two letters? Because that would make for a great gamer tag. XL was born. That is as simple as the branding was. And I kept joking every time I made a complaint, sign him for XL. 3 months down the line of this kind of just passion project being joked about, Joel came up to visit me. It was my 19th birthday at Lancaster University where I was going. I was sat in a Wetherspoons pub, smashing pints as you do as a student in a Wetherspoons pub. And it got to the point where we were like, no, let's actually do this. Let's do this. Went home that night before going on a night out, went home and started like making Twitter pages, like starting trying to design logos, like we're actually going to do this. Went night out, came the next day. And then we spent pretty much the entire sort of hungover Sunday, like building out this concept. So instead of my brother coming to just visit me to like, you know, celebrate my birthday, we also started to actually build a business plan that weekend. I say a business plan, it was a page of what we want to achieve, which, you know, was, again, the first one was be the Optic Gaming of the UK. And that's how it was performed. Yeah, that's just as a passion project, I suppose. And it was never supposed to be a career. Like we knew we had the business acumen to make it make money, but it was never supposed to be like a career or anything.
Yeah, and then we fast forward now, what, almost 10 years, right? Or is it about 10 years?
2014. So yeah, we're coming up on, it's just been its 8-year anniversary.
So eight to 9 years now.
Yeah.
And the team has developed a lot. It's changed a lot. You've been through many games. You said you started with Call of Duty as your mindset.
Yeah.
It's now more focused around League of Legends mm-hmm. due to that spot in the LEC. Tell us about the journey for XL. In particular, I want to find out about the early stages because we've all seen esports teams. We know about the current business decisions.
Yeah.
They kind of go under. But the forming stage of an esports team, you just described the first days. But that first year is huge.
It's massive. And you know, I don't think we did anything necessarily brilliant. But what I think we did well was we just had really good staying power because we're in that industry where esports teams would, I mean, there were loads of teams that were bigger than us at the time that you don't even hear about anymore. And the reason is because we just had better staying power. We weren't overspending on players. We weren't, you know, we didn't spend what we couldn't spend, right? Which sounds like a really simple thing to say, but actually a lot of that happened over the past 8 years and a lot of people wasted a lot of money in esports. And, you know, we would say to our players, like, look, this is the vision. This is what we're trying to achieve. We just aren't there yet. Come on the journey with us. Like, let's build this together. Okay, you're not going to make loads of bank in the first maybe year for playing for XL. You're not going to make loads of cash. But if we achieve what we want to achieve together, everyone's going to win. Me and Joel, we're not taking any money from this. We're not trying to scam you. We're not trying to we're putting our own, well, I didn't really have any money because I was a student. Joel had some money. But we're trying to put our own stuff in here. We're trying to get funding, you know, but we're building this together. We're not going to take any cash out until you guys take cash out. You know, this is not a scam. Like that was kind of the building blocks of it and trying to get people to believe in the story and the journey, I suppose. And I think we did that pretty successfully. I mean, we got a team in 2015, so like a year in, into the Call of Duty World League, which there were only 8 teams in Europe that were in that were pro. And we got one of those European kind of slots. It wasn't like franchise or anything. You had to qualify. But we got a team and we qualified into that. And I think our players were the only players in that league that weren't salaried in 2015. And we said to them, like, look, if someone comes in and like wants to come and salary you, we are not going to stand in your way. But whilst we've got this platform, we're going to do everything we can to go and get sponsors, go and get money so that we can start to pay you as you deserve to be, you know, you deserve to be paid. Turns out we actually did sell that team to Hyper Games, who are owned by Millennium, both names that I don't think exist anymore. And Millennium bought that team. I mean, I'm quite happy to share. It was only like 20 grand, I think, that they bought the team for.
Blimey.
But that like funded XL for like a fair amount of time, because all we were paying was really like travel expenses and entries to tournaments and things like that. We weren't salarying players. So that funded XL for like a good another, I don't know how ever many months. And yeah, obviously XL's still here and Hypergames and Millennium aren't. So we just had good staying power. And yeah, I think we always knew, we always just had this like hyper aggressive, like growth mindset of like, we really want to keep growing this and we don't want to spend what we don't have now, because we won't, we see where this industry is going and we want to be there when it kind of hits fruition. So that was really it. But that, that all sounds like really great. I mean, there were loads of times we sat there and we're like, should we just pack this in, Joel? Like, this is, you know, this is not where we wanted it to be by this point. Yes, we still believe in the vision. Yes, we still believe in the journey. But like, do we really want to do this? Like, yeah, we had loads of those conversations as well.
Yeah, and we spoke a bit about the combination of you and your brother, how you're the law guy, he's the business guy. There was also this other combination that I quickly picked up on when I met you. Both of you, I actually met just after Joel left XL to go work for Gfinity.
Yeah.
But it was very clear that he was the behind the scenes guy, you were the guy in front and telling everyone the story. Was that also a key component for you guys? Because we look now at a lot of esports teams and the successful ones, they have that face who can represent the team and can go out there and tell the story, talk to investors, talk to sponsors and so on. Was that sort of a big part of your role?
Yeah, I mean, you think, yeah, think of, yes, I've got the law legal background, but I would have made a terrible lawyer. Like, my attention to detail is awful. Like, I Joel is that guy, right? Like, Joel made sure everything was where it needed to be and was the perfect yin to my yang. Like, we just, yeah, we worked very well. It comes back to what we were saying earlier, because we're different, we made a good partnership in that sense. Yes, I was very much more the forward-facing thing, you know, forward-facing one. I was very much more in front of sponsors, business development, and that was my, you know, my game and sort of the value that I brought to the table. But to be fair, Joel, you know, although he wasn't as forward-facing to the community or maybe to sponsors, behind the scenes when dealing with like investors and things like that, he was brilliant. Like, you know, he was as good, if not better than me when it comes to like selling the vision and taking them through the journey and things like that. I suppose, yeah, I was a bit more forward facing. I think he was kind of happy with that as well, that he, you know, he felt like that wasn't his bag. And we both knew what we brought to the table. Yeah.
Yeah. Joel was always great to work with when I became a manager, because he was dealing with the managers for teams. So he knew what your side was like and was always great for that. And I think the XL journey, I started following it from Gfinity Elite Series. So a little bit into the journey, that's what, 2017?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was when I was a commentator and then became a rival when I joined Team Vitality. And one of the big things that stood out to me when I saw you guys as an org is you seemed to be the org that cared the most. Now, obviously that's something that's easier to tell when you're a British guy watching a British org at a British event.
Yeah.
You get to see the whole orgs there, the owners there, that kind of thing. It's not always as easy for American orgs in a UK venue or French org in a UK venue, that kind of thing. But I distinctly remember the Street Fighter win and the way you guys ran on stage and the way you celebrated that win with the players. You weren't just an org who were trying to make money out of things. Yeah. You wanted to compete. And I think that comes back to what you spoke about before, about the competitive mindset, is you were competing vicariously through these players.
100%.
Now, how much of that is important for these esports orgs now, where it's starting to go more corporate, and in particular those orgs where they may not care as much? How important is that passion from the people within the org?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something that we like wrote down as part of our sales pitch or whatever, but it definitely became part of our like ethos and personality as a brand. That Street Fighter win is probably still one of my favorite esports moment. Just because the relationship we built with the players and you know, we hadn't won many things. XL had been super competitive in a lot of different titles and had been up there, and people knew about us as the British org and stuff, but we hadn't actually like won shit. And I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
You can
on this
swear
podcast.
If you want, it's fine.
We hadn't actually like won anything. We didn't have any like trophies to take home, whatever. And that was like our real first trophy. And it might not have meant that much to other people, but like to us, that meant quite a lot. I mean, even part of like the, when we were going through the pitch process with Riot to get the LEC spot, those like clips of like Joel and I bundling on the stage and giving our players a big hug and whatever when they did well. That was part of, you know, the kind of highlight reel. And I think Riot really snapped onto that and were like, that's really cool. You guys really clearly are passionate about this and you love what you're building and you guys are still at the forefront of it. And that was really important to them through that process. Obviously, that's not the case now. And it's not the case for a lot of organizations. And I think it's tough. I think it's tough for them to build that, I don't know what the word is, or build their brands, to keep it corporate, build their brands in the community and in the gaming esports space when people don't really feel the personality of the brands. And you can't fake that. Like you can't, it doesn't matter how many brand values slides you create and try to, like, you know, it's part of your DNA, it's part of your personality. And I think a lot of brands are struggling because of that, and they're struggling to differentiate themselves. They're struggling to connect with a community because they just don't have that DNA. And I feel like, yeah, I feel like we did have that, and I feel like that is what made us special.
Yeah, I mean, you look back around the time when you guys were sort of growing. You mentioned Optic. You mentioned, we spoke about the G50 League Series. That's where I was with Vitality, where we had Neo at the head, who was that sort of owner who would always be doing tweets about his players, would always be watching games and so on. And now we're starting to see that growth of the new age of esports orgs, where it's an influencer who builds an org around their brand. You know, we look at K-Corp, yeah. Koi now. Yeah. You've got Moist in Rocket League, yeah. Built around Moist Critical. You've got 100 Thieves.
Yeah.
Like all of these huge name content creators.
Yeah.
And they can instantly form that passion,
yeah.
by doing viewing parties, by essentially being involved in the spectating of their players through their content.
Yeah.
And I think what you said there is that genuine passion is so much easier to come through a face of the team.
Yeah.
Whereas what we went through that generation, didn't we? And XL has experienced it as well, which, yeah. is signing of celebrities, traditional celebrities, who are seeing it as an investment rather than a passion project.
And you can't fake it.
No.
You know, and everyone always uses the word authenticity, right? Which kind of gets boring because everyone says it all the time, but it is kind of true, right? Like you can't fake authenticity. That's kind of the point of it. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that going on. I mean, the one I can definitely talk about openly because it's got nothing to do with me is Optic. And that, you know, Optic was one of the reasons I got into esports, as we said earlier. Hex really was the face of that. He also, you know, I really resonated with him because he also had the business side and the business acumen and like was very aspirational. And that's obviously what I was trying to build. But all of the community resonated with him because he actually just really cared about what he was doing and loved his players and loved what he was building. And he wasn't doing it for the money, even though he knew how to make money off it. He was doing it because of that passion. That was obvious. When Optic got bought, I can't remember why they got bought. Was it Call of Duty franchising or was it League of Legends franchising?
I think something like that, yeah.
Anyway, big corporate came in, bought the Optic brand away. Hex probably made some good money out of that, I imagine. But the biggest mistake they made was they didn't take Hex with it and it died a horrible death very quickly. And that investment was awful because you basically just stripped the face and the personality and, you know, everything that Optic stood for out of the brand. The brand didn't have enough staying power without that story and without that personality. So I think Hex got it back like a couple of years later and used a different investment firm to get it back. And now it's doing well again. So that for me is just that's the best example of why you can't do that and you can't fake it.
Well, you've been through a very similar story, very different way it composed itself, but of being part of an org through its development, passionately involved in it, and being unfortunately taken away from that project. And I can resonate a lot with that, being part of the Rocket League community and losing my position in the talent. It's less of a story than what happened to you, but you've been part of XL since the beginning. You helped form it.
Yeah.
We spoke about Joel. Joel's been in and out throughout the years. So for you in particular, I want to find out from your point of view, what happened to lead to you no longer being a part of XL?
Yeah, I mean, it was I think a lot of companies more broadly go through this transition phase, right? Of your founder can get you so far. Your founder can get you to that. You know, we got our first round of investment around the Gfinity Elite Series, and then we got a bigger round, obviously, when we went into the League of Legends European Championship. And then you get to the point where you've got some serious players involved, like some serious investors, some people with a shed load more experience than you've got around you. And, you know, they're expecting of you what they expect of the other businesses they've worked in, of people with far more, you know, business experience than you've got. And I think the level of expectation that you know, gets put on these companies when they've kind of gone through this crazy hyper growth stage to then almost, I don't know what you'd call that, startup to scale up, I suppose, to you know, to really like scale that business, take some experience that these founders probably don't have, because they, you know, they've all just been focused on getting this far. I mean, getting into the League of Legends European Championship, that was like peak of the mountain, right? But as soon as you get to that peak, you're like, oh, there's another mountain over there and I've got to go and climb that. But you don't know how to do it. Like you're learning on the job. You're making it up as you go along because you've got no experience. And that's just how it goes. And I think you get a lot of expectation in that second stage that you aren't able to match up to. You just don't have the experience to match that expectation. So there are then really two options for a company: either bring a load of great experience around you and allow you to kind of grow with the business, or ultimately bring in some experience on top of you to solidify the business and, you know, to take it on. You know, my kind of day to day with Excel was I was offered, you know, a different role in the company, and we mutually agreed, you know what, you guys have brought in some really great people. I think from a day-to-day perspective, these people have got way more experience than me. Go and run it. I'm still a founder. I'm still a shareholder. I'm still keen to be involved. Where it makes sense, get me involved, and I'm happy to help grow this thing, because ultimately I'm incentivized to do so, right? So I am still a part of Excel. I'm just not as part of it from a day-to-day perspective. And I suppose I'm not the face, or, you know, I'm not pitching to sponsors. You know, I'm not doing that stuff that I used to do. But, you know, I am still a part of it, and I do genuinely wish them all success, even just because I am incentivized to want them to be successful, right? But I can't get away from the fact that it is my baby. Like, it's not anymore. I don't own the company. It's, you know, it's definitely not my baby, but it feels like it is. And I'll never get away from that. So I'll still always cheer them on whenever they're competing in anything.
So every time I've left a team, I've always felt like I can't join another team for a while, because in my heart, I'm a part of that team. And that's for me after a year or two with a team where I am just a Rocket League manager coach in it. For you, I can't imagine the emotional connection you have with that brand, with the team, with the people who work there,
yeah,
with the players, with the success of the org. So during that transition phase, I got to speak with you a bit during that phase where you were starting to be, your responsibilities were being reduced and so on. There was a tough patch where you didn't really know what was next.
Yeah.
How did you feel during that phase?
It was hard because, you know, realistically, my entire career, apart from a very, very fleeting legal career that probably doesn't even count, was building Excel, right? So what I knew was how to build an esports brand, how to build an esports team, you know, how to do that. But you can't go and join another esports team. Not only legally, I can't go and join another esports team, but also that is your brand. Imagine competing against Excel. Like, that would just feel really weird and really strange for me. So it was super. So I had so many conversations in that period with so many different kind of people that were, I knew I wanted to stay doing gaming and esports, right? That's me. That's my career. That's where my skill set is. That's where I've got it's not really a niche. That's where my skill set is. But there's a lot of like tangential like relationships with gaming and esports now. So I was speaking to everyone where I did speak to other teams, but not to work on the team side, to maybe work on some like other stuff that they were looking at. Again, sort of linked to the team, but not with the teams. Spoke to games publishers, spoke to different sports rights holders, spoke to different agencies, and just really trying to figure out like what I wanted to do, to do next. And it was really tough, to be honest. It was a really, really tough period because I didn't know. I had no idea.
And you ended up being unfairly dismissed from Excel, as far as I know.
Not quite.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm just going based off of what I've seen. And obviously there's going to be things you can't say for legal reasons. But when people saw that, there was a lot of concerns about how that went down.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about your removal from Excel, your leaving of Excel, and how it went down?
Truthfully, I can't really talk about that for obvious reasons from a legal standpoint. You know, there was, I would say that goes down to a miscommunication between me and management, and that's all been sorted out now. So thankfully we can all move on, sweep that under the rug. As I say, I'm still a shareholder. I'm still involved, just not on a day-to-day basis, and still wish them all the best. So yeah, that's as much as I can say.
I almost got you. No, I'm not trying to catch anyone out here, but I think those kind of situations, it's really hard for, I think, anyone really outside of people who are so heavily involved with teams to understand how much it means to someone to be a part of a team. I mean, there's a lot of people who resonate with supporting a team of like, oh, I'm a big fan of this football club. But it's a whole different level when you're on the side of working with it, all those hours of every single day you put into the success of a team. So your time at Excel and the ending of it, I'm sure, was a very tough time with how it made you feel, but thankfully now you're in a position where you can still support them and carry on.
100%. And yeah, look, it was super, super tough. And I think that going back to your question before that, that's why it was so tough looking at what's next, because I am someone that wants to like fully commit myself and dive so deep into whatever I'm doing. How could I possibly do that? How could I have the same level of passion and investment that I had with Excel? Like that's going to be a tough ask for any employer.
Sounds like you've broken up with
long-term
relationship, divorced.
It is a bit. And you know, it's super hard to then go and throw yourself into something and give it, you know, that level of investment. That's why it was tough, because all of the, there were some good roles that I was talking to people about and some potentially really, really good kind of career moves. But I wasn't in it for CV building. I was like, I want to be really passionate about whatever I do next. I had a lot of advice from like family members and be like, look, Kieran, we can't all have that. Like some of us just go and do a job and we, you know, clock our 9 to 6 or whatever it is. And then we go and do what we're passionate about in the evening. And I was like, yeah, I get that, but that's just not, I'm not interested in that. So yeah, that was why it was tough.
So after Excel, you sort of created a bit of history in esports of being one of the first people who's come from esports and made a career in traditional sports of some sort. It's an unusual traditional sport because it is a very new one, but you now work in Formula E.
Correct.
How did that come about?
So again, I was having all these conversations with lots of different people, some sports teams, but I just felt like, you know, with sports teams, the opportunity wasn't big enough. But you know, compared to what I was doing already with Excel. But then when I started to talk to sports rights holders, so sports rights holders being like leagues and tournaments or whatever, I realized that they've actually got quite a, you know, big opportunity in this space, not just esports, but broadly gaming. Like the most obvious example is what FIFA did with EA and, you know, the game they created with football. That's a, I mean, it's huge. It's part of UK culture. That's massive. Obviously, right now it's not going to be, you know, called FIFA anymore, and that's broken away. But what they did was huge, and so that opportunity I was quite excited about. And being that, you know, going back to my childhood, sports was a big part of my life. I'm still a massive football fan, so I'm still a massive Tottenham Hotspur fan. I'm sorry if that disappoints anyone. And you know, so going into sports was not a massive leap for me and was kind of drawing on one of my other passions while still keeping my passion of gaming and esports. With Formula E specifically, it was a new enough sport that I felt like I could make a real impact. I feel like if I went into a Premier League or even a Formula One, like maybe I'd just die at the corporate red tape and, you know, not actually achieve a lot whilst I'm there. Whereas Formula E was, I mean, it's a commercial beast and it's way more corporate than anything I'm used to in gaming and esports, but it was early stage enough that I felt I could go in and make an impact. So that was that was part of the reason. And then partly because they're genuinely ambitious and bullish about what they want to do in the gaming and esports space. Like the CEO, who I have a really good relationship with, he really gets what I'm doing and what I'm trying to create with Formula E, and he sees it as a really important part of their kind of future of the business. And that was really important for me. So yeah, that's why I joined.
Yeah, giving you some responsibility there so you can deep dive into your role and start making impact. And with Formula E, speaking of impact, one of the things that was quite unique when speaking to you about Formula E was the environmental impact of the company. I don't know if a lot of people even know about, I mean, they probably preach it enough. It's just yeah. I'm not aware of Formula E, but I was surprised to hear about the zero carbon emissions policy.
Yeah, I didn't grow up as like a real sort of sustainability fighter. That wasn't like part of my DNA, but my girlfriend is big on all of that. And, you know, she's really educated me in that space. We've watched God knows how many documentaries around that. And, you know, I got educated, and part of Formula E's sale to me was that they were seeing that they're net zero from inception, which no other sport has done. Most sports aren't net zero now, and you know, Formula E obviously continues to be. And that, you know, having a whole sustainability department that is checking everything that any of the teams are doing and making sure, you know, where we are producing emissions, we're offsetting that, you know, all of that sort of thing. They were just miles ahead of everyone. And I thought that spoke to a few things. Number one, obviously, that's nice to feel like you're part of an organization that cares about that stuff. But number two, they're also just like ahead of the game from as a business, and that can only help being that like innovative and that sort of on the front foot. So yeah, big selling point.
How realistic do you think it is for other organizations to replicate that model of a net zero plan? Obviously not to cover all the stuff they've done in the past, but from today, from now, how realistic is it to do that?
It's a good question. There are definitely people that are more qualified to speak on this topic than me. I'll just say that up front.
So what do you need to do as an employee to contribute towards net zero? What's your day-to-day working life that contributes towards that?
When we're talking to, I mean, to be fair, it's a bit like we have like this central sustainability team, which is a bit like having a central people or HR team, right? Like that make sure those policies and those, you know, general business functions abide by X or Y. So they make it so that we don't have to think about it too much because everything is kind of done for us. So when we're flying somewhere, you know, we see what emissions we're transmitting, and then how that's being offset, you know, that's kind of all taken care of. It's good that they show all of that to us because then it's forefront of our mind just in our daily lives. But to be honest, they're the real heroes, and they do everything from a kind of central standpoint to make sure the business is operating in the most sustainable way.
So what kind of things do they do to offset the emissions? Say, for example, a flight. You fly to a Formula E event, you come back and you tell them your emissions, or they find it out for you and they say, right, we've offset it. And what would they typically offset it with?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of detail here that, again, I'm probably not the best person to delve into, truthfully. I would want my sustainability director sitting next to me to check what I'm saying. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways you can go about offsetting your carbon footprint. There are some ways that, you know, as I understand it, a little bit more dubious than others at the moment. Like you can buy these like carbon credit things, and we don't do a whole lot of that because you don't actually see how that's being offset. But there are a number of ways you can actually do that. But yeah, probably
the things like planting trees, and
that's the obvious one. Like that for sure. That is the obvious one. But then there are even like issues there when you start to uncover that of like how you're going about that. And thankfully we have experts that make sure we're not doing anything that could be seen as like greenwashing or not being true to our word. So
yeah, because I can imagine if every company tried to do it, there's only so many trees that can be planted, there's only so many of these different techniques can be. The reason why I ask is because my dad works in the power industry, and I've learned of many different things that they do to try and make things sustainable. And you know, his company's got all sorts of policies to do a similar kind of thing, like how you travel to certain places. Working from home is now a great way to be more sustainable. So all of those kind of things. I think it'd be interesting to see the future of corporations and how they integrate that kind of environmental factor.
Yeah. And it's interesting that I say there are experts now in this field that you know, it's not, it would be very difficult for a company to go and try and figure this out on their own. I mean, it's definitely doable, but you'd have to do a hell of a lot of research into this, which is why you have people that are building careers in sustainability, and you can go and hire these people, and you know, they'll help make sure from a central perspective your company is abiding by what it needs to achieve goals. So yeah, I wouldn't expect many companies are going to be able to do this on their own. It's definitely viable to do it, but you're probably going to need some expert help.
So Formula E, what are the events like? You travel around the world for all these events.
It's a work hard, play hard culture is the way I would describe it, which suits me down to the ground. So that's absolutely fine with me. Everyone works super hard. To be fair, I'm not operational, so I don't build racetracks, right? There are people that do that, and they work seriously hard for the events. It's pretty impressive if you go 2 weeks before an event and you see there's nothing there, and then in 2 weeks' time you're racing. What those guys do, those guys and gals, unbelievable. Like seriously impressive operational. I'd say, I think like 50% of the employees at Formula E are operational people, as opposed to like backroom staff like me, because it's a serious operation they put on. It's very, very impressive.
Yeah, I've seen esports events set up in a day, packed down in an evening. I can't imagine a racetrack goes up and down that easily.
No, and the thing about Formula E is because we are sustainable and we have electric cars that don't produce a lot of noise pollution, they obviously don't produce any other type of pollution, we can race in city centres. That's kind of the whole like USP of Formula E is, let's go to the people. Let's not go and race, Formula One, but at Silverstone, which is like 3 hours outside of London. Mm-hmm. Like, let's go and race in the city. Let's take the racing to the people. And we can do that because, you know, we don't produce any emissions or anything. But the problem there is you're creating yourself an absolutely logistical and operational nightmare of trying to close down streets in the middle of Paris or in the middle of Seoul. You know, like it's a serious operation that you have to undertake, and you have to get a lot of backing from the local cities in order to do it, which isn't always possible, which is why we don't race in every city, because maybe that mayor doesn't care, right? Doesn't want to do that.
I hadn't even thought about that as a benefit of Formula E, that you can go in places that you wouldn't be able to with Formula One. And I feel like that's almost something that you could put as your primary selling point for a lot of people, because, you know, we have bike races in city centers for the reason that you described. Doesn't create much noise and all that kind of thing. Marathons, all that kind of stuff. But to have a car race, you couldn't do that with an emission-producing vehicle.
I'm pretty sure, and this is way before my time, but London weren't that keen on the idea initially. Whoever was mayor at the time, maybe it was Boris, let's blame Boris. London weren't that keen on the idea initially. And so what Formula E did was they took one of their cars and razzed it round Battersea Park in the middle of the night. And obviously, like, certain people were like, well, you know, sort of saw it and were like taking pictures of it or whatever. But there were no noise complaints, no nothing from any of the like residents. And so they then sent that to the mayor and went, see, like, we can do this. Like, so that's quite cool. And they used to race around Battersea Park before we now moved to the London XL, which, by the way, for me is the best event of the year, not just because it's my home race, but we race actually like inside, like the cars go a little bit inside the XL center for some of it, and then they go around the docks, and then they go inside the XL center, and so you have this like, it's like a like party in there. You got like dance music, lights, and the cars whizzing past, because obviously they can race inside, because again, there's no emissions, there's no.
Well, the first thought I had is when a Formula One car goes into a tunnel, you get that massive explosion of noise.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, it's gonna be so cool when they go inside, and there's gonna be, oh, there's no noise, no. So you don't even get that like boom of a car going through an inside place.
If you've ever been to F1, you need to wear ear defenders.
Yeah,
because it actually can hurt like your ears, especially if you were inside with them. It would be unbearable. But we can do that. And the cool thing is, I actually quite like the sound of them. They sound like a Star Wars TIE fighter. So I actually think they sound quite cool. But for a proper petrol head, they're like, where's the like combustion engine sound? And I'm like, yeah, well, it's not there. But what you can hear more of is like the tires screeching
and
things like that, which is like a different sound that you don't get with Formula One. So
So, Kieran's confirmation, Formula E is a squeaky sport. I'm interested to know for you, you know, we are in your phase of life where you're doing Formula E, and we spoke a bit about XL. I guess, what's the future? What thoughts have you got on the future of Kieran Holmes Derby? Is there any big projects you've yet to do in esports, sports that you really want to achieve at some point?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty happy doing what I'm doing at the moment. I'm learning a lot. For me, it's all about learning, like having every day as a school day, doing something different every day, broadening my skill set, just growing, I suppose, having that like growth mindset. That's really important to me. So Formula E is completely different. Day to day, I do completely different things than I did at XL, and that's really important for me. But it still, you know, leans on my expertise of understanding the gaming industry and the esports industry and being able to link that back. But yeah, I'm doing a lot of like licensing deals, which I've never done before, and things like that, which for me are super important. So I'm pretty happy. I don't know what's next. But you know, maybe my role grows at Formula E, maybe I get more responsibility, maybe I get to do some other stuff there. Or maybe not. Maybe I top out and then go and do something else in the gaming and esports world. I think I would come, if I was going to move, I would come back this way, more so than like go further into sports. I feel like I'm in like this middle zone right now, where I've got like 1 foot in sports and 1 foot in gaming. And I think I'd realistically go further towards gaming than further towards sports, just because that's where my like real like passion, and that's where I've built my career. So yeah, who knows?
Well, I'm excited for your future. And I guess if there's anything on the top of your head right now that you think about in terms of challenges of working in the gaming industry or the sports industry, I mean, off the top of my head, I think of all the travel, but I know you get nice fancy travel whenever you go abroad, so you probably don't find it as bad. But, you know, spending as much time as you do, we've just come back from Vegas with the Esports Awards. And, you know, the first thing we both said to each other when we saw each other was like, how you doing? And we both went, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Struggling to sleep right now. Now, this is not the worst problem in the world. We're very fortunate with what we do to be where we are. But how has there been points in your career or your life where the grind of the, in like especially you said about passion before, the intensity and grind of what you're doing has worn you out?
Yeah, so a couple of things there. Number one, I'm not going to complain about traveling the world, because that was one of the big selling points of going to Formula E, was I knew I was going to be able to travel the world and I wanted to do that. It is massively draining, and it is a drain on your, you know, your relationships, your personal life. It's tough to keep that in the same place it was when you're, you know, pissing off every now and again to literally all over the world, because Formula E is genuinely global. And then the other piece that you're kind of picking up on there is post XL, I didn't have the mental capacity to go and start something on my own again. Like, I felt like I needed to go and work for someone else. I needed to go and get into an established company and sort of grow what I was doing inside that almost safety net of being in a kind of commercial beast, purely because I was just knackered and worn out from that experience. Doesn't mean I'll never do that, but just at that specific time, I didn't have that energy to go and spin something up again. So I felt that for sure.
Yeah, and I guess, is there any moments you think back to where it did become too much? Is there anything at the top of your head you think of, maybe with relationships or with, you know, family life or your career, where you thought, do you know what, that was a bit too much?
No, moment where I've sort of broke down and gone, like, this is too much, I need to stop everything. I've not had that, but I definitely think I'm a massive work in progress when it comes to, like, on everything, to be honest, like business, personal, whatever, like definitely think work in progress on all of that. On the personal side, I'm a terrible son. Like, I don't call my parents, and I definitely should do that more. As years have gone on, I've become a worse brother. Now we're not working together. You know, I could definitely call my brother more and check in with him. Friends, I've actually tried to smallen, that's not a word. That's just not a word.
I think everyone knew what you meant though when you said smallen.
Smallen, that's a great word. I've tried to shrink, that's a better word. That's actually a word.
It's a synonym for smallen.
I've tried to shrink my friendship group because I had like a lot of acquaintances, not friends, like not people that I could talk to about things, you know, people that I'd go for a beer with, have a laugh with. But yeah, a lot of acquaintances, but not a lot of friends. So I've tried to kind of shrink that and have a smaller set of friends that I can actually, not that it just I extract value out of, but I also add value to, right? Like friends that I will be there for them. I'll ask them when stuff's going on, and sort of, yeah, just be a better mate. Because I think I got to the point where I was so focused on what I was doing with Excel, I did become a bad everything else. And yeah, thankfully I had that kind of moment of realization and realized like you need to, like, balance is everything. So I'm now trying to be a bit more focused. I'm still terrible at all of those things, but I'm working on it, right? I'm trying to be better at the personal side and the business side. But yeah, very much a work in progress.
Well, my mum listens to every podcast and she'll be listening to you just there and thinking, that sounds like Mike, you know, because I'm exactly the same. I am a terrible son. I'm a terrible brother, terrible friend a lot of the time. And it's actually something I've gone through the same journey as you have of, I need to fix this. I think it's very common amongst people in startups, people who are workaholics, who are obsessed with their career for whatever reason. You know, for you, it was obsessed over a brand that you were building.
Yeah.
Me, it was obsessed over a game and a career in that space. And it does get in the way. And it's very common amongst, I don't want to say successful people, because it's probably common amongst the unsuccessful people who are overworking themselves. And I think it takes a lot for people to take a step back and realize those things. I guess, is there, you said you've gone about trying to fix that. Is there anything that you've done recently you think of where you think, actually, I've started to make some progress on that?
There's no secret sauce as I'm experiencing. It's literally just, it's kind of, yeah, it's working at it. It's like anything. It's trying to get better at it. I've heard of a few like tricks that I haven't gone as far to do this yet, but I've been thinking about it, of like booking out time in your diary, in your work diary, of just like, here's 2 hours, do a helicopter view of your life right now. Think about your friends, think about your family, think about everyone who needs maybe you to reach out and say hello. I think I have those moments without booking it in my diary, but it could get to the point where that's not a bad idea, like booking a couple of hours on Monday afternoon when maybe there's not as much going on and going, actually, I'm going to do some check-ins with some people. Maybe it gets to that. At the moment, it's more just being cognizant of that on a day-to-day basis. When I'm in the car, I'm very good. That's my like new thing, is every time I'm in the car, because when you're commuting, you're always listening to podcasts like this or whatever, or reading. In the car, I used to also do like podcasts or whatever. Now I'm like, actually, let's use this time to call someone. So put on the hands-free, of course. And talk to someone that you need to catch up with. Normally it's my dad, because I'm terrible at calling him. But
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people out there who might take a little bit of a moment to look at themselves and think, oh my, perhaps that's me. And it's a very easy to do as well, with the way the world works, with online friendships, with parasocial relationships with all these people we follow online. And I think there was a bit of a eureka moment for me when I started to realize who my actual friends were, based off of, I mentioned it before, I think when Freya was on, I can't remember if it was her, but when you have those big successful moments, or the moments where you lose your job, or the moments where you, something happens in your life, it's that point where you start to think, who do I want to reach out to me right now?
Yeah.
And at that moment, you can start going, well, I should reach out to those people when they need me. And you start to smallen your friend group and shrink it down to a size where you can start managing it, because it is very easy now with our thousands of friends and followers online who are actually just, I say acquaintances, in some cases they're not even acquaintances through the online world that we live in.
And I think it's okay to have those. Like, I think it's absolutely fine to like have like a broader friendship group or acquaintances that you will hang out with from time to time, because I'm a big believer in you'll learn something from everyone you meet. And if someone you haven't seen in a year, you'll probably learn something from them. So I'm a big believer in that, but make the core time is you need to make time for that. Yeah, that smaller friendship group and your family. And then that kind of frees up the space to go and, you know, meet new people, hang out with people you don't normally hang out with. And I do think that is still important. I don't think that you should never do that. But yeah, I would say make time for the more important people. And as you say, if those people in your worst times or darker times are reaching out to you, is that what, there's that saying that's like, when the tide goes out, you'll see you swimming naked. Like those, the people that are swimming naked are your mates. Like they're the ones.
I've not heard that one. I'm not going to use that ever again.
They're the ones that, you know, when the chips are down, they're being there for you.
Mm-hmm.
Other people just want to kind of be associated with you when you're high flying.
Yeah, a lot of amazing lessons and stories to hear throughout this podcast. So thank you, Kieran, for coming on.
Appreciate you inviting me. I've enjoyed it. We talked about stuff I didn't think we were going to talk about. So it's cool.
Yeah, and I love just deep diving into the journey, finding out what led you to where you are today, and also learning. You mentioned about learning from your acquaintances, and I hope through this podcast, you know, 100 episodes in, I hope to be a much more educated human being, and hopefully the people listening will be. Lots of amazing lessons from you, a lot of insight into the journey of creating an esports org, and you know, your journey through Formula E. I think I learned a lot just speaking to you now about Formula E that I probably should have learned about when we were hanging out together in person. But you've been a role model for me in esports and for many people, and it's been an honor sharing my journey alongside you in the UK esports space. And I'm sure a lot of people will feel the same way of how you've taught them something they never thought about, or you spoke at a panel or a you know, an esports event, and they learned a lot from you. So thank you for everything you've done in the esports space. And I guess we'll finish off with the closing question of, what does gaming mean to you?
Christ, I didn't plan this. You know, when you listen to like podcasts and they've got this question they always ask, and I'm always like, I know exactly what I'd say there. Now when you're in the spotlight, it's not so easy. What does gaming mean to me? In a word, passion, and then I'll expand on that. Gaming is my not only what I do as a career and sort of, you know, what I do, how I'm kind of building my career through the space. For me, it's still my biggest outlet. So if I just need an evening to just let off steam and do nothing other than play video games, I feel amazing after doing it. And it's a super important pastime for me, and it always will be, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.